All of us are on a journey of becoming, a never-ending journey in pursuit of truth and deeper union with the divine. As you know, faith is a complicated thing, and this journey of becoming can be both difficult and painful. Far too often, we have not been given a space where we can safely address the complications and issues that arise naturally. My name is Joshua Patterson, and I am also on this journey of becoming. I am dedicated to inviting you into my story and creating a space where questions and critical thinking are welcome. I want to take an honest look at the issues and questions so common to this shared journey. I want to genuinely seek out what it means to follow Jesus in our ever-changing world, in our unfolding and expanding universe, and in our pluralistic society. I have come to know that doubt is not the enemy of faith, but rather that both doubt and curiosity are two of faith's biggest allies. I have learned that the Christian faith is more about wisdom and love than it is about correct doctrine or belief. And I believe that we are being invited to continually seek out both wisdom and love, renewing our minds, expanding our hearts, and rethinking our faith in the process. Thank you for joining me on that journey. All right, friends, and welcome to another episode of the Rethinking Faith podcast. As always, I am your host, Josh Patterson, and with me today is Mark Feldmeyer. Mark, how are we doing today?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me, Josh. Great to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for coming on today and hanging out, spending some time, and also for the kind of flexibility that you offered with your schedule when I when I had to bump our conversation. So I appreciate your graciousness in that regard. Yeah. So, just for starters, kind of like podcast 101 type stuff, for our listeners who might not, be familiar with yourself or your work, could you just maybe give us a little bit of a background of, who you are and what kind of, things you find yourself doing?
Absolutely. I am, currently the lead pastor at a United Methodist Church in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, just outside of Denver, St. Andrew United Methodist Church. I'm a United Methodist pastor. I've been a pastor for 31 years, 9 years at St. Andrew. And prior to coming to Colorado, I'm a native of Southern California, and I was a pastor of two churches, one in Orange County, California, and one in San Diego, North San Diego County in Encinitas. So I've been here 9 years and lead a wonderful church, a Methodist church that is intentionally progressive and inclusive and generous and welcoming and what we call in the Methodist tradition a reconciling church, which is intentionally open to all people and inclusive of LGBTQ especially.
Awesome. Yeah, I had spent a little bit of time working in a Methodist church vocationally when my wife and I lived in South Florida.
Yeah.
I was a what was my title there? Student director, student youth director, something like that. during my time there. And it was right around the time during General Conference, when there was a vote around the LGBTQ kind of questions, and that kind of didn't really go how people thought it was going to. And the UMC that I was a part of was also, I guess you said called it like a reconciling church. They were open and affirming. And, my buddy Chad was the worship pastor. He's openly gay man. Mm-hmm. And so that was like a particularly... interesting, and that sounds too cold, but like interesting kind of experience to have as not someone deeply connected to the UMC, but also just to see kind of like the pain and anguish that came with that from like different members in the congregation, the pastors on staff and things like that. So,
yeah. It's been an especially traumatic 4 or 5 years. And in the Methodist church, and things are shaking out, and people are finding their places and spaces, and it's good to be on the right side of history.
Yes, I currently so I was in vocational ministry for about 6 years, and ultimately ended up leaving for a variety of complicated reasons, and became a brewer, like making beer.
Awesome.
And I did that for like 3 years, but now I actually just started at a tiny little Episcopal church as their parish administrator.
Yeah.
And that has been interesting. There's definitely some overlap from the, you know, the Methodist church within the Episcopal church, but it's also like a progressive affirming space. And it's been interesting to kind of like risk myself in that, you know, direction once again, back into kind of like church world after the kind of things that have happened. But it's been a really good experience so far. I've been there for like probably a little bit over a month now.
All right. So you're finding some of the landmines and some of the wonders as well.
Yeah. Right. Right. Oh, yeah. But so, Mark, you recently had a book come out called Life After God, Finding Faith When You Can't Believe Anymore. And one thing that I'm kind of passionate about here, at Rethinking Faith, but just in general, is kind of the power of story. And so I really like engaging guests in such a way as to like couch the conversation kind of with some of their story, if they're comfortable with that. And so you wrote a book called Life After God. And so I'm curious, what in your story kind of leads to writing a book with a title like Faith After God?
Yeah. I think what you're naming is the book is somewhat provocatively titled, and that's both intentional, but also there's a double ring to the title. On the one hand, what we're talking about is living a life after the God that you can't believe in anymore, and that means a departure from some of the more orthodox established doctrines and dogmas that we've been told we have to believe in order to be Christian. The other ring on that title is the word after, implying the work of pursuit. And so as we leave behind that one God we can't believe anymore, we're pursuing a God that we've maybe sensed has always been there all along, but we haven't been given permission to pursue. And so there's that. And you know, as it relates to my own story, it is it's a story that's been unfolding for about 30 years, and began, as I talk about in the book, in the opening chapter, my experiences at Claremont School of Theology in the 90s with some of the great theologians in the process movement, including David Ray Griffin in particular, and John Cobb, and how they had a profound influence on me in redefining my faith and getting me on that journey.
Yeah, I I love the kind of story that you open the book with. And as I was reading, I was very curious as to what professor at the school you were talking about. I'm not going to ask you to name them, you know, publicly, because you obviously chose not to do that for a reason in your book. But I was like racking my mind trying to see like, OK, so like about what time would Mark have been there? Who was teaching at Claremont at the time?
Yeah.
It's a fun story.
Some people know that who it is, and others suspect who it might be. And I was intentional about leaving his name out because he's somebody I value and honor greatly, and wanted to protect him a little bit. But he had a profound impact on my life, and that story, that opening story, was somewhat traumatic in terms of the crumbling of my the faith that I brought to seminary, and that journey that it launched me on was transformative.
Yeah, I think too, perhaps maybe that story gets at, and maybe not, correct me if I'm wrong, it kind of gets at the, you make like a distinction in your title, because you say finding faith when you can't believe anymore. Yeah. And so I like that differentiation between faith and belief. Mm-hmm. And so maybe one way to demonstrate that distinction would be to say, like, in that story with this professor who kind of perhaps shattered your belief in a certain kind of God. But in turn, that kind of then pushed you into like this faithful pursuit in a life after, right? Trying to following after God, trying to search. So is that like distinction fair?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a departure from that place of certainty toward a deeper understanding of what faith, especially from a New Testament sort of perspective, that word in the Greek pistuo, which we've interpreted often. Well, you find it in John 3:16, the famous passage, that whosoever believes in him. And so we immediately think that is some rational intellectual assent to a particular set of beliefs or doctrines, when the word really implies more one of deeper trust and believing on or being a part of the journey with God. And so absolutely, that was the moment when I had to leap behind what I thought I knew and what I thought I was certain of to find a God that was more believable. Yeah.
Yeah, that, I mean, I didn't have the same kind of like, you know, finger gun story with the professor that you did to kind of spur that on. But I definitely have had, and I guess even continue to have, these mini like a death of God, in the sense where it's like, okay, my understanding of what I think, you know, that word God means, having like that kind of die, reemerging into like another kind of understanding, for then that to have like another kind of like mini death. And almost just to this point of trying to pursue after a more beautiful image of God, one that I can trust and one that, you know, I can love and worship and things like that. And I think perhaps for listeners as well, they'll probably be able to relate to that to some extent, right?
Yeah. I think what I encounter with folks that I both work with and friends and colleagues, I think that journey for a lot of people begins with the conundrum of theodicy. And I talk about that in that opening chapter. For me, that's sort of what sort of brought the Jenga tower down for me, was this idea that there's some bad stuff in the world going on, and globally, locally, and personally, and all of it at once was happening in my life. And I was not able to resolve that paradox of the all-powerfulness of God, who, according to that doctrine of omnipotence, could stop things from happening that are bad, and the all-benevolence or all-loving nature of God, who wants the very best for us. And so many people, especially who are in the process theology world or open theism world, would kind of begin that journey with that paradox and have to find a way to redefine the nature and power of God and embrace more fully the love of God. Yeah,
absolutely. And so for you then, what are maybe some key aspects or some aspects you think are worth highlighting that relate to this kind of to like your understanding of the nature of God that kind of doesn't look like the one that you initially started with?
Yeah, certainly. I think I brought into my journey when I began seminary this idea of God's being able to intervene supernaturally, unilaterally, in the ordinary events of the world. And while I held on to that belief all my life up to that point, I can't really ever remember thinking of moments when I had actually experienced that personally or even in the world. And I had spent the first 4 years before that in undergrad majoring in religious studies, studying not only theology, but in particular the Jewish experience in the Holocaust, and trying then to still try to reconcile this conundrum. And so what I immediately began to understand when it comes to the nature of God, and of course I'm still understanding this and trying to integrate it in my life, but this idea that that it's not to say that God is not powerful or even supremely powerful. It's to say that the nature of God's power is one that is more generative and more persuasive and less coercive and unilateral, so that God doesn't make us do anything that we don't want to do. And you could even argue that God doesn't have that kind of power. Folks like Thomas J. Ord and others would say that very emphatically. God can't do that. And I would affirm that. I think we can begin with understanding the persuasive nature of God, who is ever with us, but also ever before us, wooing us, beckoning us, calling us toward greater experiences of becoming. And that's the God that I think as I discovered that nature of God, I could look back over the course of my life and see that kind of God at work always in my life. And I continue to feel that today.
Yeah, I too kind of started with the problem of evil that kind of, you know, broke a lot of things for me. And ultimately, it came to kind of like a process relational understanding of the divine, introduced first by Thomas J. Ord. Before I knew who Tom was, I picked up his book, The Uncontrolling Love of God, like right out of college, just because I wanted a book about God being love. And when I pulled it up on Amazon, that's the one that I found. And so for me, kind of coming to the understanding of, this God that you're talking about, a God who is love, a God that is non-coercive, etc. It kind of ultimately became a like, wow, this is so beautiful that it ought to be true kind of thing for me. And then on days when I still have a hard time finding like belief, right? It's the faith, or like Aaron Simmons, he's a philosopher and friend of the podcast. He defines faith as like risk in a direction. And like ask yourself like, okay, what is worthy of like risking yourself towards? Yeah. And that kind of like process relational understanding of the divine is one that I think is worth risking myself towards.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's kind of been the role it's played for me.
And when I talk to people about, you know, essentially what we're talking about is this work of deconstruction and reconstruction of our faith. And I hope that my book does both, but it is, it has been described by others as a book of apologetics, so to speak, in the sense that I am presenting, I think, my understanding of a God that is worthy of our love and worthy of our devotion. I think what you're naming, though, is this: there is we have to give ourselves permission to just let go of those things that aren't worthy, even though that they're sort of loaded into our religious, backpack, and we've been carrying this stuff around forever. And so, to give ourselves permission to let go of that which doesn't feel life-giving anymore, and that certainly doesn't serve us in terms of empowering us to make a difference in the world and work for shalom in the world. How do we just simply turn our gaze toward that which, as I say in the book, gladdens our hearts and gives us life and joy?
Yeah, and an interesting word too that you've used a few times, and also you have a whole chapter in the book about it, that like it carries baggage sometimes for people, which is that word call. And so I know my wife, Noelle, had an interesting experience one time when we were about to move back from the state of Florida to Maryland, which is where we're from. And she was really sad about leaving her job at this like really awesome animal shelter she had in Florida. And like one of her coworkers told her, was like, oh, well, like your work is just a job. Your husband actually has a calling. Oh. And so that like where she doesn't like it, because yeah. it seemed, you know, like that she was being written off. And so when you think of call, like the kind of way you present it in the book is not, it's not negative. I don't think it carries the same kind of baggage. So I'm just interested, when you think of the call of God, what kind of does that mean to you?
Yeah, what comes to mind immediately is maybe what I would describe as sort of the impulse toward becoming. And that I think is both an internal impulse that originates from our own heart or consciousness, if you will. But it is also, as I argue in the book, it is external to us in the sense that it's bigger than us. And there is, I think, a call that resounds throughout the universe. And that call, we see that call in the opening verses of the creation poem of Genesis, in which God says, "Let there be light." And as I talk about in the book, that phrase, "let there," appears in the jussive mood, which really is not a coercive, you must do this. It's not a command or an order. It is simply an expression of what could be. It is, you could become this, you could do this. And that voice is spoken to the tohu vavohu, the soupy mess of the primordial, chaos. And so we have a faith story that begins with this idea of a call that transcends us as persons, that's throughout the universe and heard, and that all creation is responding to. And that at any moment, any of us and any of all creation can finally say no and resist the call. And as the ancient Hebrews would teach, there could always be this moment where all creation could say no, and this whole universe would return to the tohu vavohu mess that it once was. And so this is all held together by our faithful response to the call toward becoming more. And as we would say, more in the process, moving toward novelty and adventure and zestiness, as Whitehead would say. And so the intensity of experience toward becoming who we might be and who we could be. That's the call. And yeah, man, I get so annoyed by people who think, as you expressed with your wife, that calling is somehow religious in nature. I think it transcends religion. It's profoundly spiritual, but it transcends our forms of religion. And to your point, my wife works with, she's an educator. She's a behavioral therapist with kids with on the autism spectrum. And I know she lives a calling, because every day she comes home either worn out, sometimes crying, sometimes elated, but pouring herself into this as she gives herself toward these kids. And so, yeah, calling. Yeah, you can be a banker, you can be a trash man, you can be a gardener or a pastor or a podcaster, right? Or a brewer. That's a great calling. I love that one.
Yeah, I love that. Just the more invitational kind of vibe that has. But even too, like, I think of, something silly, like, I don't know, you go and you see, like a play or a musical, and just like, you know, something about that grasps you, and you see like the lead character or something, you're like, wow, this person is doing exactly what they're to be doing right now. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of like another, they're living into their calling, so to speak, or something like that. And so I think there's, if that makes sense, these, just these moments of beauty that, for whatever reason, I find myself moved by, I kind of think about calling in there sometimes as well.
Well, and I think to that point, I think what we're talking about is universally experienced, even and maybe even especially outside of the Christian Hebrew experience, right? Like I talk about in the book, the Japanese culture has that word ikigai, which is, you know, your reason for getting out of bed every morning. So yeah, when you see that performer on stage and you realize, I mean, I've had that moment. There was a moment here, I'm in Colorado, and my first concert at the Red Rocks, which is, you know, a must go to venue for concerts. My first concert at the Red Rocks was Tom Petty just before he died. And I had that same like elation watching this human being perform like such a professional, and it was transcendent. And he was living his calling too. Yeah.
Yeah. That has to be a cool experience. That seeing a concert at Red Rocks is definitely on my list of things to do. in life.
Unforgettable.
Yeah, I bet. excuse me. And so one thing that at least I kind of see them tied together, calling, and then also in the book, which you call like the aim of God. Mm-hmm. And the reason I kind of see them going together, I'd be curious what you think, is like, if so in the book you essentially say like the aim of God is for shalom, right? And so then that call, so like we have this kind of like teleological goal of shalom, and then that call kind of functions as like an allure into like, hey, look at this thing that is, you know, good and beautiful, true, shalom. Do you think they kind of play together like that?
I think all of that which calls us toward becoming is leading us toward that experience of shalom, whether that is shalom at the deeply personal level or shalom at a global or even cosmic level. You know, we think sometimes we understand this concept of shalom as being peace or well-being. I think unfortunately that that often misses the mark, because shalom from a deeply Hebrew perspective understands that true peace comes from the bringing together of opposites. And so as I talk about in the book, even a Jew who greets you with the word shalom also says farewell with the word shalom. This idea that in our comings and our goings, two of the most opposite experiences in life, shalom is what holds them together. So that when we think about the struggles in our personal life, we can't experience true peace until we are reconciled with that part of us that is not at peace with ourselves or with the world. And I think that vision of shalom is expressed, for example, in the great vision of Isaiah, the prophet, who talks about the lion laying down with the lamb, and the child playing over the hole of the asp. These are like the most completely divergent, opposite experiences with sheep and lamb, sheep and lion lying down together. And yet the vision of shalom, the biblical vision of shalom, is that is the ultimate aim of God in the world. And so it translates to our own lives, but it translates beyond us to a global experience of shalom. Yeah. And so every calling, every beckoning is leading us toward that reconciliation of opposites.
Yeah, that I love the reconciliation of opposites bit, especially too, because it makes me it adds some kind of like, I don't know, it adds something to, you know, the teaching of Jesus to like, hey, you shouldn't just love, you know, your neighbor, but you should also love your enemies. And that kind of like enemy love, I feel like is also like a call into that kind of like bringing together of opposites. If you want to look at an enemy is right, that kind of like opposite counterpart kind of thing.
It's radical. Shalom is meant to be a radical reality that takes more than our own unique individual efforts to accomplish. There has to be some divine collaboration and participation in that for it to happen. Not miraculous, but deep collaboration.
Yeah, and the collaboration piece there too, also I find inspiring, and also I think it has the power to be deeply transformative, because then it's not this kind of I can sit on the sidelines and read my Bible, be nice to people, say my prayers, and just, you know, pray that God comes and fixes everything all of a sudden. But rather it's like this invitation from the divine that kind of like, psst, as you know, you say in the book. And then when we have the ability to either say yes or no, and then, do we want to give into that vision of shalom? Do we want to participate? And I think that, like, hey, like, you have a role here too, is something that felt lacking to me in kind of the more like evangelical tinged version of faith I had been, you know, handed growing up.
And I think what you're capturing is, you know, this journey toward this word that we get, another word we get mixed up with sometimes, is this word salvation, and how we personalize and individualize salvation as this experience of being loved by God. I talk about in the book that, I mean, that's certainly part of the journey, and yet so many Christians start and end there. But the fullness of salvation leads to shalom, which is we understand that God not only loves me, and not only loves those that that are like me, but God loves other people too, which means I'm sort of not so special. And God loves Gandhi, and God loves those from other traditions, and those from other experience outside the tribal sort of parochial boundaries of our faith. But ultimately, genuine salvation, which achieves shalom, says God loves my enemies, and so maybe I should too, and maybe I should reorient my life toward loving them to the best I can, and to work for their well-being too. So yeah, this is big stuff.
Yeah, absolutely it is. And I like, you know, you kind of bringing salvation into the mix there. That's a question that I think, you know, oh, I know personally, like experientially, I get asked a lot. It's like, okay, Josh, this like process stuff is nice, but what about salvation, kind of thing? And so I love, you know, thinking about salvation as not necessarily something that happens, you know, post-mortem after we die, although maybe there's something to that, but rather it's like almost like a way of like life, a way of being and living in the world. And that's being offered to us, right? From the aim of God, from the whisper, the call of God, into this like better way of being human, that is kind of built on this idea of like, shalom, or like wholeness is often sometimes how I like to think about it. And I mean, I've said this a million times on the podcast, so listeners are probably tired of me saying this, but the way that's most helpful for me to think about sin, or at least where sin comes from, is this kind of like fracturing of shalom, or like fracturing of the wholeness in such a way where if I believe that I'm separate from you, then I can cause you harm. You know, I could be racist, I could, you know, like step on you to get that promotion, etc. But it's like that fracturing of the wholeness then is like where the sin arises from. Or
theologian Platinga describes sin as the culpable disturbance of shalom, and I think that for me just has a ring of deep truth to it, that I think you're naming right there, that fracturing, the impediment, that sometimes is subtle and sometimes profoundly intentional and systemic and the culpable disturbance of shalom is pretty good.
Yeah, that I really like that, culpable disturbance of shalom. I'm writing that down for later reference. But it's interesting too, because I think that then also can apply to our relationship with the divine. Like when there are different obstacles that are put in the way of having this kind of experiential relationship, something like that with the divine, that too, at least in my opinion, seems to be this kind of like culpable disturbance of shalom, where we somehow end up believing that we are also separate from the divine, you know, in some kind of sense. I don't know. That's just something that came to mind.
Yeah, I just preached this last week's sermon was on the Exodus story and that moment when the Hebrews find themselves on the shorelines of the Red Sea. And so that Red Sea sort of is the symbol of the disturbance of shalom, or the impediment towards shalom. And sometimes that's real and physical and systemic in the world, like racism or homophobia or sexism. Sometimes it's as personal as addiction or anxiety or depression or the things that we've gone through, our trauma. And so there's a lot of resistance to the call towards shalom. Some of it self-created, and some of it created by forces beyond ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the one that you kind of named there about the kind of even the disruption within ourself, is one for me that I've been trying to focus on and recognize more recently. Because previously I had kind of talked about I call it like the myth of separation between, between you and I, between creation and between the divine. Then also I recognize like there's also this kind of like separation from myself almost, mm-hmm. That like is a lot of the kind of inner work that can be done through something like therapy or contemplative practices or, just having close friends that you can talk to or something like that. And so, yeah, that kind of like internal shalom is something that, I think would be fair to say a lot of people today probably feel very deeply. And I think that is a big cause of tension for people in the world today.
It's really interesting the way you describe some of those strategies for cultivating shalom in your life. They're all profoundly relational, whether that's with a therapist or with friends or you are in relationship with somebody else, which is the only way to get to shalom, I think, ultimately. But but what you're describing, I think, sort of fits into that whole process or Whiteheadian worldview of that the fundamental nature of the universe is one of events or occasions or experiences, if you will, as opposed to our modern worldview that says we're all just a bunch of atoms. And it's hard to make atoms come together. And it's so as long as we see this world as just being a bunch of substances that are disconnected or sometimes loosely connected, but not really relational, we can't get there. We can't get to the vision of shalom that you're describing. And some of those strategies, I think, they're very curious and insightful about how to achieve that.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, you kind of touch on some of that divide that kind of stemmed out of even just like a philosophical distinction with like Descartes. or at least yeah. Descartes like often becomes like one of the whipping boys for it.
Yeah. He wasn't all that bad.
Right. Descartes did many great things, but that kind of like bifurcation of nature kind of thing, or even this is somewhat off topic, but also related. And it's just because I have ADHD and this is what I've been reading a lot of recently is study of like consciousness stuff.
Yeah.
And even like Galileo's Error is a book that I've been enjoying, and I kind of like the idea of like pan experientialism.
Yeah.
You know, a la David Ray Griffin kind of thing. Yeah. But yeah, that and this is the bad thing about ADHD is I don't know why that was important.
Well, but mainly
we
live with this sort of presupposed dualism that separates body and spirit, matter and spirit. And so, like, look, every Sunday people walk in my church, and the last thing I want them to do is feel like they have to leave the real world to come to church, to that they have to leave behind the physical world to experience the spiritual. I want to bring the physical into the spiritual and the spiritual into the physical, and find ways to say there are really aren't distinctions there, that it really is ultimately all spiritual, if you will. But we do this. We divide up our world into things that are purely physical or scientific, and those that are spiritual and religious, and we'll just never get, we'll never get there if we stay in that world.
Yeah, which one of the things for me that I kind of came to, you know, after, you know, the kind of death of the God that I was originally handed, was the this idea of like panentheism. Mm-hmm. Which you talk about in your chapter on divine presence, which for me, it was always really, I always had a hard time understanding the divine presence bit. I remember asking questions about it in youth group, very distinctively to the youth pastor, Justin, about like, well, wait a minute, you're telling me that we are like separate from God, but also God is omnipresent and God is everywhere. I'm not like, and you said something about sin and like, God can't be around that, but this, you know, and so it's always very confusing, only to find out later that like panentheism is not necessarily something foreign to the Christian tradition. And so I'm wondering like, how is that like understanding of divine presence kind of played a role in your.
Yeah. And it's not that far from sort of the panpsychism or panexperientialism that you were mentioning just a moment ago, that there's this understanding that we are in the experience of God, just as the experience of God is in us. And I think a lot of Christians would affirm the latter, but wouldn't quite understand how our experience is in and held within the experience of God. And I think that's, that is sort of the entryway toward understanding things like just the nature of prayer, for example, right? Marjorie Sue Hockey, one of the great process thinkers, wrote a book in the 90s. I just reread it on my sabbatical this summer, Into the Presence, this idea that that prayer is entering into that experience of God. It's not presupposing that there's a difference or a distinction or a distance between me and that which I'm praying for, but that what unites me and that other person I'm praying for is the presence of God, and that we're both in it together. I mean, it's just fascinating, beautiful. It's a beautiful understanding of prayer. And if we understand that God has experiences, and that we influence God, that changes how we perceive prayer. It changes how we interact with others, knowing that that. I mean, this is weird. I mean, maybe a good friend in California, one of my best friends, hadn't talked to him in a while. One night last week, I was thinking about him, like on a Tuesday night. I was thinking about my good friend Bill, and I had to call him. And I was going to call him the next day. I get up in the morning, he calls me. At 9 o'clock in the morning, right? What is going on there? You know, is it a coincidence? I think some from the more scientific modern worldview would say it's just coincidence. But maybe there's something else there. We're all participating in the experience of God at once in ways that we can't calculate or measure or comprehend.
Yeah, that's a beautiful story. And I've heard, you know, similar stories to that. And I do always kind of ask myself, like, what is going on here? But I love that idea. Actually, it's funny, friends joke with me. There was a period of time when I was like really actively pursuing understanding of things like spiral dynamics and things like that, which I still enjoy. I can talk about it. It's fun. But I would always reference like collective consciousness. And like, so if somebody would tell a story like that, they'd be like, oh, collective consciousness, Josh, we know, shut up. I think just how you named it is so beautiful, that idea that we are participating within, you know, the experience of the divine. And even within that too, you mentioned, as you were just speaking, the kind of, So what I'm trying to say is you have referenced God as like a co-sufferer, that we are experience has the ability to influence God's experience. Yeah. And so that's kind of where the suffering bit was coming from. But you talked about it in the book in such a beautiful way. I really appreciated just this real, like, not just in the sense of like God as a friend who's there to like hold your hand while you're suffering, but in a very real sense, like that suffering is felt and experienced by the divine. The divine knows what it's like for Josh Patterson to feel suffering or tragedy, etc.
Like integrated into God's own experience. So that's different from Plato's God, who sits outside of time and space and looks down upon all this sort of unmoved, as we would say, the unmoved mover, who sometimes cares, but only from a distance. And so, we're talking about a whole different understanding of God that's pretty near.
Yeah, the kind of understanding of God that's is like closer than our very breath. Which is cool, because I know within the book too, you did some cool work with some of the like the Greek and Hebrew language around breath, and that was a fun bit. And I mean, even too, just the kind of thought experiment, maybe it was called like Caesar's last breath or something like that.
Last breath. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That I hadn't heard of that, like named that before. But you know, I had heard, you know, similar things about like being stardust or being present at, you know, the Big Bang or something like that. But just that idea of breath and then like kind of applying that to Jesus. I don't know. That was really cool for me. I liked that.
And none of that is, I think it's another expression of Whitehead would say nothing is lost in our experience, that it all remains in some way. And I guess my point in the book on that story is, or that illustration is, just science has language for that. We're talking about the same things, just from with different language.
I think so. And I think that too is part of one of the reasons that I have found process so alluring, so to speak, is that kind of resonance with science. But also, before kind of embracing and exploring this like process world, I very much was in the world of like the mystics. And a lot of the way that the mystics speak also play very nicely with process, and then also with like some of the, you know, science and this kind of thing. And so it's just interesting to see this perhaps different names or different ways of naming a similar experience or something like that. I don't know.
And I think what we're describing is actually a return to a more biblical, if you will, certainly a more Hebrew understanding of God that has been experiencing layer upon layer of Greek philosophical concepts that have obscured the purity of some of that experience and redefined it in ways that that are no longer working for a lot of people and a growing number of people, sadly.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, just even experientially for myself, but also from talking with listeners or like other podcast friends and like their communities that they have kind of cultivated, mm-hmm. it seems to kind of be a thing that's kind of like sitting at the top of the surface right now, which is cool, yeah. because you have a wonderful and beautiful book to offer into that kind of conversation. Kind of in this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of thoughts that come to mind. One, that we're living sort of in two worlds, but we haven't moved into the third world. And one of the worlds is where most evangelicals still live, which is a pre-Enlightenment world that that still wants to affirm complete supernaturalism and omnipotence and some of these big concepts we're talking about. And then there's this other post-Enlightenment liberal mainline, mostly world, that has fully embraced science and the modern worldview as sort of the ultimate truth. And I think what we're talking about is and hoping to create is this new expression of faith that transcends that whole debate and doesn't have to be anti-science. In fact, can take science with it into a new and richer expression of a faith that, again, ultimately is 4,000 years old, and we just left it behind.
Yeah, absolutely. That the kind of rejoining, or like, you know, for some of the big flashy buzzwords, like a more like that, like naturalistic understanding, like naturalistic dipolar theism or something like that, right, for the nerdy people. Exactly. it's such a I don't know, again, that like that vision for me is something worth risking myself towards because I find it beautiful and compelling, and so ultimately for me today in my own, you know, journey of becoming, it is ultimately geared towards like, you know, that image, or that kind of that story, or however you want to phrase it, because I do find it so compelling and beautiful, and it does make me want to get out of bed in the morning, right? And work towards an image of shalom and offer that not just for myself, but hopefully for everybody, right? For all of creation, including maybe our extraterrestrial friends or something like that, if that's such a thing. You know.
Yeah, we sadly, so much of our conversation about faith are centered on the human and on the earth, and we forget that there may be other, God may have other loves out there that are not uniquely human or earthly.
And well, I guess to kind of maybe like land the plane, so to speak, or kind of wrap up our conversation, I'm just curious what thoughts you might have towards something like eschatology, when we think about a God who is not, coercive or manipulating or has the whole story already written. What kind of, when you think of eschatology, what kind of thoughts come to mind for you?
Yeah, I think toward the end of the book, I talk about the distinction between how Ephesians, for example, describes essentially how this is all going to end. And it's quite different from what most would argue from a more evangelical perspective, would argue is sort of the rapture, rescue planned for the worthy and the holy. And so this vision that I lay out in the book is really one. Eschatology leads this idea that this journey we're on ultimately and universally leads toward the divine gathering up of all things, so that nothing is wasted and nothing is left behind. That's a direct contradiction to the Left Behind book series that is completely unbiblical and yet super profitable for pop culture Christians. But the true vision that we find in Scripture is one of gathering up. And again, another expression of shalom, that all of this ultimately leads or wants to lead towards shalom if we and creation is willing to cooperate and collaborate in that journey. And nothing has to be wasted and nothing has to be left behind. And I think that challenges conventional notions of hell and even conventional notions of heaven. At least in terms of sort of framing those two concepts in physical space language, right? I think that has been when people ask about process theology and eschatology, and is there really an eschatology in process thought? I think there is. It doesn't look as linear as what most Christians describe today, you know. So yeah, I would affirm this idea of gathering up all things in the divine.
Amen. Well, that's a beautiful vision that I appreciate as well. So not that I'm the final arbitrator of all beautiful decisions or something like that.
We're all just grasping at different parts of the elephant, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Mark, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I really enjoyed your book a lot. You write in such a way it has this very like pastoral and genuine kind of feel and vibe to it. But also in such a way where you take something like, you know, we've said it a few times, process thought, and kind of, which is notoriously difficult to grasp, and you kind of offer it in this like beautiful way that it doesn't have to be confusing and
Accessible.
You know, yeah, accessible is a good word. There we go. That's what I was looking for. And so I really appreciated it. And I know I said I was going to add, that was my last question, but I want to ask you one more thing just to kind of tap into that pastoral side of you, even though I would argue this whole conversation has been that. But for listeners who maybe are kind of wrestling with or trying to put something back together, or maybe are still in the process of deconstructing less beautiful images of the divine, what advice might you have, or what's something you might want to say to them as they embark on that journey?
Two thoughts I have, one that I describe in the book and one that's more fresh to me. The one is that I think we ought to sit with all of those questions and doubts and paradoxes that we struggle with and then pick through them. And first find that in our faith which we can live with, and not only live with, but that which gladdens our hearts, as I say, and sit and behold them and give thanks for them, for their generosity and for the way they accompany us on our journey. And then to look at those things which are difficult to believe, but maybe we're not just quite ready to leave behind yet, and to sit with them, but to allow them to be, because sometimes they can work in ways that maybe later on we don't need them and we can leave them behind, but they can create the tension through which and by which we learn and engage and experience the divine in more robust ways. And then all that stuff that we just find traumatic, the stuff with teeth, the stuff that says, you know, you can't do this or else. I think, as I describe in the book, you just pick those things up by the tail and you walk them out the door and you drop them on the patio and you close the door. And then you get back to living in a faith that is believable. And I think you can make the journey the whole way just like that. So that's one thought. The other thought quickly is just that I've been struggling with this deconstruction, reconstruction language because I've used it and it's appropriate. I've also began to think that it's interesting. One of the most popular dreams that humans have is this dream, and maybe you've had it, Josh, where you, in the dream, you are in your house and you suddenly go down a set of stairs or down a hallway, and there's this whole part of the house that you'd never been in before. I don't know if you've ever had that, but it's a frequent one for me. And I read this because I was concerned about my mental health. But it's one of the top 10 dreams that humans have. Like they have a house with rooms that they've never been in, and they've been there all along, but they just didn't know they were there. And maybe that's sort of the journey of reconstruction, to redefine it as just moving out of some rooms that are too small for you and finding those rooms that have been there all along that are just waiting for you to occupy and explore. And those rooms, if they're safe, open the door and walk in. So those are some of my, for what it's worth, some of my advice.
Yeah, thank you. The house one is funny. I definitely have had that kind of dream experience.
Good, I'm not the only one.
Right. Yes, you're not the only one. The research appears to be true. But yeah, the rooms thing is so interesting for me because I did kind of grow up within evangelicalism, which I think is like very much an ahistorical kind of faith. And it kind of sets itself up as this is Christianity. And so then when that broke for me, it was like, well, I guess I can't be a Christian anymore, only to find out that like, oh, well, wait a minute. What are all these other rooms that I didn't know about this whole time? And just kind of recognizing how deep and wide and vast the tradition is and how much room within it there is, even for, you know, people like myself. So I've appreciated that. And I like the room imagery.
Yeah. Definitely. Good.
So. Cool. Mark, again, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your book. I'll be sure to put a link to it in the show notes for our listeners. But is there anywhere else you might want to direct listeners to, maybe like follow along with your work or connect with you, anything like that?
Yeah, you know, I've got a website, markfeldmer.com, which is has a lot of resources and some other content that I've written. And it's easy enough for folks if they want to follow along. This is the kind of stuff I preach. And so I preach it every week when I'm preaching, which is about 40 times a year. And so people can follow along with some of my sermons and messages through gostandrew.com, which is our church website. And they can subscribe and get all that material as well.
Awesome. Well, I'll be sure to link those things for you guys listeners as well in the show notes just for your convenience.
Awesome.
But yeah, again, Mark, thank you. And listeners, thank you so much for hanging out today. And as always, guys, go in peace.